From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is the U.S. fighting a permanent war in Afghanistan? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. 16 years after September 11th, the Trump administration is divided over America's longest war. With 8,500 troops still in Afghanistan, the Pentagon wants 5,000 more. But the U.S. couldn't get its way when there were 100,000. Advocates of continued U.S. involvement say it's all about the Taliban gaining strength, and even more extreme groups now involved in the country. Skeptics point to massive financial corruption and ask if there's any plan for ending a conflict that's killed and wounded so many American soldiers for so long. Later on today's Talking Point, America's most notorious nuclear power plant may be shutting down. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. The Trump White House is divided over the Pentagon's request for more troops in Afghanistan, where the U.S. has been fighting for the past 16 years. Is there a formula either for victory or a political settlement? Is there an end in sight for America's longest war? Today's Talking Point, the nuclear plant at Pennsylvania's Three Mile Island suffered a partial meltdown that closed one reactor in 1979, the worst accident of its kind in American history. Now the second reactor may be forced to shut down 15 years early. We'll find out why. First, this news update. President Trump returned from Europe to new reports about FBI investigations of his inner circle. Reuters reports one subject of inquiry. Did the head of a Russian-owned bank propose to the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, that economic sanctions be relaxed so that Russian banks could offer financing to people with ties to the president? Jonathan Landay is reporting the story for Reuters. Thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
Is there a suggestion that Kushner himself might have benefited from such an arrangement?
Well, we understand it and reported that the FBI is looking into that. The question is relevant only because of the Kushner organization's problems financing a building they bought in New York, 666 Fifth Avenue, and the need, as I said, for financing, extra financing for that purchase, and whether or not it's our understanding whether or not that figures in to the FBI inquiry. We're not sure. We don't know. But the fact is that they are looking at that question.
Now, it's my understanding that some Democrats are demanding that Kushner's security clearance be reviewed. But he was a civilian at the time that these meetings allegedly took place.
That's true. At the same time, though, I think it's been reported that he did not disclose some of these contacts that he was supposed to in applying for his security clearance. And therefore, you've heard Democratic calls for his security clearance to be lifted.
And Ted Lieu, congressman from California, is demanding that Kushner quit. So who was the banker that Kushner allegedly talked to?
So the banker's name is Gorkov, Sergei Nikolaevich Gorkov. He was a trained intelligence officer. He went to the academy where Russian intelligence officers are trained. He was appointed by Mr. Putin to head a bank that is now under U.S. sanctions as a result of actions taken by the former Obama administration, and he met with Mr. Kushner last year in December at Trump Tower in New York. The bank itself has, in fact, confirmed that meeting did take place. It said it was a meeting with him as well as other representatives of U.S. banks and businesses as part of preparations for a new corporate strategy. And the question is, why would Mr. Kushner meet with the head of a Russian bank that is subject to U.S. sanctions, whose chief wife is a trained Russian intelligence officer who was appointed to the chairmanship of the bank by Mr. Putin.
The Trump administration, as I understand it, or at least supporters, are saying that what they were trying to do was set up a back-channel communication between the president and Vladimir Putin.
Well, we reported something like 10 days ago that Mr. Flynn was involved in trying to set up this back channel. At the time, we did not report that Mr. Kushner was also involved. And it was what we were told by our sources is the function of this back channel, which we don't know was ever actually consummated, was to circumvent the U.S. national security establishment, which neither the Russians nor Mr. Trump and his associates trusted the Russians for obvious reasons. You've heard President Trump rail against the U.S. intelligence community, accusing it of being behind some of the leaks about the questions about his relationship with Russia.
Has Kushner had anything publicly to say at all?
We tried for some time to try and get Mr. Kushner to comment. We could not.
And others have as well, I take it, and there's nothing on the record.
At this point, only from his lawyer, who told us last week as part of the story that we reported that he had made thousands of calls and was unaware of whether of he participated in thousands of calls during that period that we wrote about, which was a period in which he had undisclosed contacts with the Russian ambassador to the United States.
Right.
No recollections of the calls as described.
Okay. And that lawyer, interestingly enough, worked at one time for the Clinton administration.
Yeah, that's true. And for the CIA, I believed at one point.
CIA as well, Jamie Gorelick. So everybody's in on the act.
Well, you know, I suspect that we haven't heard the end of this.
Again, we're talking about Jared Kushner and his responsibilities. If he were to lose his security clearance, what jobs would he not be able to continue with?
Well, it'd be very hard for him to continue to be a senior advisor to the President of the United States, because in that position, you have to have access to much classified material. If he loses his clearances, he has no longer that access.
Jonathan Landay with Reuters. Many thanks.
My pleasure.
In a moment, is the U.S. fighting a permanent war in Afghanistan? This is To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. The U.S. has been fighting the war in Afghanistan for 16 years. Since the peak of 100,000 American soldiers, their number is now down to just 8,500 at a cost of $3.1 billion a month. Now the Pentagon wants to send 5,000 more, but the Trump White House is divided. Eric Schmidt is national security correspondent for the New York Times. And Eric, it's always good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren. How are you?
Very well. Thank you. What is the purpose of adding 5,000 to the 8,500 that are there now?
So what General Nicholson wants to do, and he's the commander, overall commander of American forces in Afghanistan, is being able to push a larger number of American advisors and trainers down to lower levels who will work directly with the Afghan forces that are combating the Taliban and other Islamic extremist groups in Afghanistan right now. He has proposed anywhere between 3,000 and 5,000 troops that would be American. Right now, that is being debated, as you said, inside the administration, because not everybody thinks that's a good idea.
The president was supposed to make a decision about this before he met with the NATO powers in Europe. He didn't do it. Is that because there's indecision now?
I don't know if it's so much indecision as he's obviously got a few other things on his plate, obviously with all these Russia investigations and dealing with that and coming off of the NATO and the Middle Eastern trips. And you have to also remember, President Trump has just not put a very high priority on Afghanistan. He spoke very little about it during the campaign. He hasn't really addressed it very much since becoming president. It's not high on his list of priorities or his advisors' priorities. So with everything else kind of swirling around, the decision on Afghanistan Afghanistan kind of gets pushed to the side. Now, that said, we're expecting something in the next couple of weeks.
Is anybody fully involved with Afghanistan as the soldiers over there continue to do the best that they can? There wasn't much asked when the hearings were held for the new Secretary of Defense.
That's right. Well, I mean, obviously, there's still, because it is, as you said, now the 16-year war, there's still a large number of people in the government and in Congress and certainly in Europe, because NATO still contributes roughly 5,000 troops to the campaign over there. This is still, you know, one of these important missions for the American military and its Western allies, both to stabilize the government of President Ashraf Ghani, who's the civilian president in Afghanistan, as well as to keep the Taliban from taking even more territory than they have now, and also to provide security for U.S. intelligence forces that use Afghanistan as a base of operations, not only to go after insurgents in Afghanistan, but to reach across into Pakistan, where there are still several threatening groups there. So there's still a number of interests and security interests for the United States to follow up with a significant troop portion in Afghanistan.
So apparently the disagreement is between the generals, including General Nicholson, and political aides, including Steve Bannon and others in the White House. Are they mainly concerned about the $3.1 billion a month?
They're worried about the cost, of course, at a time when they're trying to shrink government and they're having to find ways to pay for their budget that they proposed. For Mr. Bannon, of course, he's very wary of these kind of foreign entanglements and just sees additional troops going to Afghanistan as kind of a slippery slope to nation building. Another skeptic is Jared Kushner, the president's very influential son-in-law. Now, he hasn't come out with a specific opinion on the troop proposals, but he's been critical of existing American policy in Afghanistan and kind of sees his role to make sure his father-in-law gets what he calls credible options for the way forward. And then you have the others, Secretary Mattis, the Defense Secretary, and, of course, General Nicholson, and the National Security Advisor, Lieutenant General McMaster. Mattis and McMaster served in Afghanistan, so they have somewhat of a vested interest, I think, in trying to make sure that comes out, in their view, comes out right.
Eric Schmidt with the New York Times. Kate Clark is with us, senior analyst at the Afghanistan Analyst Network. Her involvement in Afghanistan started in 1999. She became the BBC Kabul correspondent and the only Western journalist based in that country at that time. Kate Clark, good to have you on our program.
It's great to be with you. Thanks.
I want to ask you for an entire history of the war in Afghanistan. It's been 16 years, but what would you say is the state of it now?
I mean, just to say that for Afghans, of course, it's much longer. It goes back to 1979 with the communist coup d'etat and then the Soviet invasion in the 80s. This has basically been ongoing war for almost 40 years. And the last 16 years are merely the latest phase. I'd say one of the issues that's come up is that this is very much about the plan to put more American soldiers on the ground and various other aspects of the plan that General Nicholson has come up with do look to continue the status quo of the war. This is very much keeping things as they are. And any other option will probably be worse. And that's one of the issues when trying to sort out from a Washington, D.C. perspective of what you do with this country, because all other options look to be worse.
What do you mean by the status quo? How would you describe it?
Well, at the moment, you've got, it is largely an Afghan versus Afghan war. It's Afghans who are fighting and dying. You have the Taliban on one side with, you know, a few foreign militants fighting with them. And on the government side, you have 350,000 Afghans under arms. So if you think about the number of foreign troops on the ground now, and they are mainly non-combat, they're actually quite few. Of course, both sides get strong international backing. With the government, it's obvious, but with the Taliban, they get strong backing from Pakistan, which is largely sanctuary for their people and their leadership. So this is a war that's sort of become, it's almost like the war has become the default option in Afghanistan. And no one can quite imagine how to stop it. And while the bid by General Nicholson is laudatory in trying to prop up government forces to hold territory and, if possible, get a bit more back, it's basically keeping the war as it goes. This is not a radical, it's not a radical proposal.
Kate Clark again is with the Afghan Analysts Network and a veteran reporter in Afghanistan. Andrew Basevich is with us. He's Professor Emeritus of History and International Relations at Boston University. He's also a retired Army colonel, veteran of the wars in Vietnam and the Persian Gulf. His latest book, America's War for the Greater Middle East, a military history. He is a frequent columnist as well as a author of books. Colonel Basevich, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you.
Based on what we've heard so far, what's your take on what's going on in Afghanistan? You're one who has suggested that we may be in, we may have accepted a sort of permanent war.
Well, I think we have. I mean, I take seriously General Nicholson's assessment when he last appeared before congressional committees, where he described the war as stalemated. I have to say, I cannot understand how the rather minimal escalation of Western forces that he proposes is going to have any significant impact on that stalemate. Ms. Clark just described the U.S. policy as in essence an effort to maintain the status quo, maintain the war. I suspect that that's fairly accurate. Nobody has a clear understanding of how to end the war. But I'd also argue strongly that if indeed that's our purpose, just keep this thing going because we can't think of anything better to do, there's something fundamentally mindless and I think even immoral in such a perspective. It really testifies to the bankruptcy of the U.S. national security apparatus that we can't come up with a better solution.
Let me go back to Eric Schmidt with the New York Times. Is that the reason that there's concern in the Trump White House about continuing the operation in Afghanistan?
Well, that is one of the concerns, is the corruption that the President Ashraf Ghani has vowed to root out. He just will not be effective in doing so. And we've seen how many billions of dollars of American aid go down into corruption in that country. So I think there's within the skeptical crowd within the administration, and particularly within the White House, that is one of the leading arguments, is what steps can really practically be taken to avoid having even billions more of American aid and treasure go to no use.
But Colonel Basevich, you said that there was corruption. I take it that's what you meant when you said it was immoral on the American side as well as on the Afghan side.
No, there certainly is, by all reports, extensive corruption. It certainly appeared to also be true that prior efforts to root out corruption have had no positive effect whatsoever. But when I referred to the war being immoral, I do think, seemingly, a war can only be moral when it is purposeful, when there is some expectation of being able to achieve reasonable political objectives through the expenditure of some reasonable amount of resources. So here we are, 16 years into this war, countless billions wasted, tens of thousands of people who have been killed, and if the intent of U.S. policy is simply to continue the conflict, then it seems to me that is immoral, that is wrong, that is indefensible, and I think it's a judgment on our national security establishment that is the case.
Kate Clark, back to you. You said that the principal objective is to maintain the status quo, that nobody knows how to end it. What do you say to the colonel's contention that this is ultimately immoral?
The problem is that we have history to guide us here. And in 1992, the Russian government withdrew its support from the Afghan government, the communist government then. The result was state collapse and a very bitter civil war. Out of that emerged the Taliban, out of that emerged the space in which Al-Qaeda grew. And that scenario has not changed. Now, in the 1990s, it was possible for Moscow to withdraw, and no one really had to bother much about Afghanistan, even though the civil war was very, very brutal. If there's a withdrawal of support this time, it's that the state cannot support itself. It doesn't have the funds to support itself. I'm not talking about soldiers here. I'm talking about money. And, of course, the prospect if that happens is far worse now, because you've got Afghanistan still as a very attractive place for international jihadist groups. And this is the issue that keeps all the international players in Afghanistan. It's the nuclear issue, the nuclear option of what happens if you withdraw support. Now, and that is why the status quo looks relatively attractive. And I would say that there's various ways in which you could break this stalemate. One is persuading Pakistan to stop supporting the Taliban. It's been tried and failed. More could be done, but that's not necessarily a workable option. The second, as the other commentators have talked about, is getting the Afghan state to stand up to the mark, to actually recognize that the wolf is at the door and that it needs to reform itself. It needs to have an effective fighting force to actually do this. And part of the Nicholson plan is to give the state some support and to give Ashraf Ghani some support while they clean up their act. And I don't know if they can or they can't, but that would be the other way of breaking the stalemate. Of course, the other way is to look for peace. And up till now, for the last 16 years, everyone has been looking at ways to fight the war and to defeat the Taliban, or at least to hold them at bay. There are ways that you could imaginatively look for peace. There are people with creative ideas in this area, but they are not being pursued.
What does it mean to say that Afghanistan has an attraction for international terrorist groups? And does that suggest that those groups are threatening to us in the United States?
Yes. I mean, I don't think they're particularly attractive to Afghans, but for international militants, Afghanistan is an iconic place. It is the place where a superpower was defeated, the Soviet Union, in the 1980s. It's the place where the Taliban had their what they see as an Islamic State. It's a place where they can still hope to fight American soldiers. Not many of them on the ground anymore, but there's still a hope for that. It's the place where the Twin Tower attacks were conceived and ordered. It is an iconic place for international militants. It's also got the Pakistani tribal areas just across the border, which have their own history of militant groups. And there are people within the Pakistani military that do also support the idea of international jihad. So Afghanistan is a problem. And it's a problem both, you know, for itself, because obviously for Afghans suffering in this war, and we've got 1 million Afghans displaced from their homes, the worst casualty figures for dead and injured last year. It's a problem for them, but it's also, it is a global problem. And I would say that fresh thinking is needed.
Okay, we're going to leave it at that until we take a very brief break. We'll come back. We'll continue this conversation with Colonel Basevich and our other guests as well. We'll also talk with Cale Weston, who has a diplomatic experience in Afghanistan. And on our talking point, we will be talking about America's most notorious nuclear power plant, which may be shutting down, talking about Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. One reactor shut down in 1979 after a partial meltdown. The other one is going to shut down now 15 years early. We'll find out why. This is To the Point from Public Radio International. Well, we're not only back with To the Point. Once again, after 16 years of war for the United States in Afghanistan, the generals are calling for 5,000 troops to increase the 8,500 that we already have in that country. Andrew Basevich, retired colonel and a professor at Boston University, a longtime author as well, is saying that we don't have a way to stop the war. Therefore, it is immoral to continue to supply troops, put them in harm's way without any easy outcome in mind. Easy outcome is probably the wrong term, and Colonel, I apologize for that one. But respond, if you will, to what we just heard from Kate Clark about all the reasons we ought to be there.
Well, I mean, I don't want to pose as an expert on conditions within Afghanistan. I believe Ms. Clark's credentials are vastly greater than mine in that regard. That said, it seems to me that the premise of her argument ends up being one that says that Afghans are incapable of sorting out their own affairs, that somehow or other the answer, the solution, if there is one, needs to come from the West, needs to be provided by outsiders. And I'm simply skeptical of that. The reason for my skepticism is that we've been at it for 16 years now with very little to show. And indeed, I'd argue very strongly that if indeed there is a Western-devised, Western-imposed solution that somehow involves the use of outside military power, then it's sure going to take a heck of a lot more than an additional 3,000 to 5,000 U.S. troops to make that happen. The magnitude of the problem of pacifying Afghanistan and transforming it into a viable, functional nation governed from Kabul, the magnitude of that task is so great that it is going to require resources on a scale that is orders of magnitude greater. And there is zero evidence that authorities in Washington or elsewhere in NATO have any desire to do that, nor do the American people or European people. So again, what I'm struck by is that this proposed escalation is a way of evading a problem rather than an effort to solve a problem.
Once again, I should point out, 8,500 are in the country now. 5,000 more or so are being asked for. At one point, there were 100,000 American troops in Afghanistan. Cale Weston is author of The Mirror Test, America at War in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's former State Department advisor in Iraq and Afghanistan, received the Secretary of State's Medal for Heroism. Cale Weston, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
What about this? So would it take orders of magnitude more than we are deploying now, and perhaps more than we ever have? And are we, as the Western powers, unwilling to do that? If so, why do anything at all?
Well, a couple of points. One would be that, you know, my 7 years in both wars taught me a lesson, which is the United States, even as a superpower, has real limits. And the Afghanistan war demonstrated that when I lived in the East in Host as well as in Helmand. I lived through the 33,000 troop surge that President Obama authorized. And of course, there was no bridge too far for the Marine Corps. But I would say that what I think President Trump and his war cabinet are now focused on is balancing priorities and what level of risk are we prepared to take, particularly in the Afghanistan-Pakistan border region. And having lived for a year and a half just across the border from Miram Shah, I think we do need to remember the context of September 11th, 2001. So I've long advocated the lowest troop level we can get to in order to endure and have this really become a low-grade conflict that isn't, you know, top of the news is probably the better and safer bet. I was against any big surge because I think that wears out our military. It creates civilian casualties, and I think it in some ways creates a dependency on us that isn't healthy for the Afghan government.
What is it about September 11th, which was largely accomplished by people of Saudi origin, that makes it necessary for us 16 years later to be trying to support the government in Afghanistan?
Well, Osama bin Laden, you know, had his own personal safe haven in the easternmost edges of Afghanistan. And if we go back, you know, President Clinton at one point sent some cruise missiles in to try and kill him. And then he, you know, spent some time in Host where I lived. So when President George W. Bush, and I was at our mission to the United Nations at the time, pointed to Chapter 7 UN Security Council resolutions and said, Dear Taliban, hand over Osama bin Laden. They didn't do it. So I think at that point, obviously, after, you know, 3,000, almost 3,000 Americans were killed, there was a case for how this war got started. Whether or not that war obviously was fought well, I would agree, I think, with Dr. Bacevich and maybe Mr. Smith on this. But I think where we are now is, you know, what is the risk that we face if we pull out completely? And, you know, we haven't talked about Iraq, but I think it's a relevant parallel. I think the Iraqi government, in effect, forced the administration to get out. But what happened after that? And I think with the current administration pretty much self-absorbed in a lot of other issues, that this will become background. But a complete pullout, I think, is too high of a risk. I do think that ISIS Khorasan, what's going on in Nangarhar, does have ties to U.S. national security. And I'll just put one other example out there. If you remember Faisal Shahzad, who was a Pakistani immigrant, he failed to blow up a vehicle in Times Square. And I think if he had been successful, there would have been a lot of magnifying glasses back on the Durand Line, the border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan.
You mentioned Eric Schmidt, our first guest, who was with the New York Times. Eric, back to you. What about the Trump White House once again, when the president campaigned on the idea that he doesn't want the United States to be the policeman of the world anymore, and that we would focus on America first? Is that part of what is holding up the commitment of anything further in Afghanistan?
Well, maybe part of it. And again, the president really did not focus on Afghanistan at all during the campaign. This was not part of his effort to intensify the fight against the Islamic State. And it's interesting in that General Nicholson has singled out the ISIS group in Afghanistan for some of the most punishing attacks, with the so-called Moab bomb, the giant bomb that was the largest unconventional bomb in the arsenal that's been used today. It was used against ISIS Khorasan in the caves. They've had some special forces casualties going after it. And this is against a group that is not the major threat inside of Afghanistan at all, but it definitely fits the narrative that President Trump has campaigned on and is focused on as president. That is to intensify the fight against the Islamic State, not just in Iraq and Syria, but everywhere. And so I think it's interesting to watch that kind of that evolution, not so much in focusing on the larger problems, whether it be the Taliban or the Haqqani network or rebuilding Afghanistan or whatever it is. But it's what the focus there has been on Afghanistan has been focused on this one ISIS component that operates in the eastern part of the country there.
Kate Clark, back to you with the Afghanistan Analysts Network. Again, with so many years of journalism in that area, did the Moab bomb, so-called, the mother of all bombs, was it effective against ISIS?
It's part of an ongoing campaign and not unreasonably used according to the sort of the tactical description of what was going on. So American and Afghan special forces were trying to take two key valleys that are really, really difficult to take. And they kept, when they attacked, they found that ISIS fighters were coming out of nowhere and ambushing them because there's this complex of caves. And they were losing people and they were making very, very slow progress. So from that point of view, it was, you know, from a military point of view, it was a reasonable thing to use. The campaign is still ongoing and it's really, really fierce fighting. I would agree with Eric Schmidt, though, that in Afghanistan, ISIS is actually a marginal group. By far the main opposition is the Taliban. And since the American and the other international militaries stopped, basically ended their combat operation, the American military does have something of a combat operation, but largely this is now, as I said, a war conducted by Afghans. Since then, the Taliban has been taking territory, and it keeps taking territory from the Afghan government. The Taliban proved stronger, the Afghan forces proved weaker. And the issue behind sending these 5,000 advisors, I'm just filling in the background, they're largely not there for combat. They're largely there for training, advising, and assisting. So to talk about putting American soldiers in harm's way is something, it's not quite accurate. We're not seeing the casualty figures that we saw even 2 or 3 years ago. Most of the people dying in this conflict are Afghans now. And I absolutely agree with the other speakers that this is something that the Afghan government has to grasp. It is up to Afghans to solve this conflict. The American military, American taxpayers, British taxpayers can support the government to survive and to stop the state collapsing and for Afghanistan to yet again become a haven for internationally minded jihadists. But to solve the war, you have got to have the Afghan elites taking their country seriously. And up till now, that hasn't really happened. And I would put Ashraf Ghani, I would say he does take this seriously. There are certain individuals within the government who do. But as a group, the Afghan elites are still not, they're still not taking the war seriously or the fate of their country seriously.
Mr. Ghani, of course, the president of Afghanistan at this point. Colonel Basevich also referred to correctly as Dr. Basevich. How do you respond to the argument just made that the 5,000 new troops aren't going to be to that extent in harm's way, that in fact they are there to train, advise, and assist rather than to shoot and be shot at?
Oh, I know that's the case, and I don't believe I made any reference to concerns about American casualties. They are way, way down. My argument was, and the purpose of those forces to train and advise is to perpetuate a war, and some of us may disagree. I think that that war is mindless, and therefore simply to perpetuate it just strikes me as unreasonable. But to get to another point that was made, and that is the argument that we need to continue this war because this is where the 9/11 conspiracy was hatched. I know that's true. It's also true that bin Laden's long, long gone now. But more to the point, what's really true is when you look at the scope of U.S. military undertaking since 9/11 in a variety of places, the effect has been to expand the geographic presence of the jihadist forces. It is not true, in my estimation, that Afghanistan in any way somehow represents ground zero of the jihadist threat. And indeed, if the argument is that wherever there is a potential of a jihadist threat, we have to have U.S. forces present, well, then we're going to have U.S. forces present in a whole passel of countries for a long, long time to come. I don't think that makes sense. I don't think that's sustainable. And again, I think that the real issue here is to recognize how brain dead U.S. policymakers have come in their efforts to wrestle with a problem that is a very serious problem.
Cale Weston, your response to that?
Several points. You know, we are a magnet for terrorism where we are. If we, I think, surge U.S. forces into valleys and mountain ranges that we don't belong. But, you know, at no point in my 11-year State Department career was I advocating flooding the zone. What I think that my basis for at least the argument I'm making is that a complete pullout, you know, we shake our hands and say 16 years is enough, is a risk. And whether that risk, you know, is bigger than, you know, what we're trying to do back in Iraq or Syria or other parts of the world is, you know, like a hard balance to look at from, I think, a war cabinet perspective. And I also believe that probably President Trump's war cabinet has a lot of war wisdom in it, but leaders who have been maybe too close to the tactical fight. And I know I probably represent that too. But if you completely say this is immoral and we shouldn't do it, I think there's a way of looking at this war from the collaborators and the partners that we've developed over 16 years. You know, for a decade and a half, we've said that girls' education, you know, that building the next generation of Afghan leaders is an important strategic objective. It's about human capital. It's not about drones. It's not about the MOAB. And I would say that a low-level commitment, which is not defined by thousands and thousands of troops, but a low-level U.S.-led commitment is a lesser risk than saying, we're done, you know, we're out. And I guess that's probably where I disagree with Dr. Basevich.
Very quickly, what about the corruption, which I understand is extraordinary, that money goes to soldiers that don't exist and is simply sucked up by the Afghan establishment, whoever represents it at the time, and that it's just being thrown away?
You know, the amount of money that we've invested in Afghanistan is tremendous, but do I think that we can afford $3 to $5 billion a year for a sustained commitment, given the risk, I think, that is still real? I don't think it's any bigger than necessarily any other part of the world that we're focused on, but I do think it's a risk that we need to look at realistically. So the corruption, I think, I believe has gotten better. I've looked at corruption at the governance level in terms of the provinces. I've looked at it at the district level, and I'm still in touch with people in Kabul. So it is a U.S. focus, and we should probably have some conditions tied to that. And if we do, then perhaps, you know, an enduring partnership, I think, is really, unfortunately, the least bad option. And that's really where we are, only bad options right now. But the worst option, I think, would be to say that the Russian government, the Iranian government, the Pakistani government, the regional dynamic is going to be better off with a U.S. vacuum.
Andrew Bacevich, unfortunately, just 30 seconds left. But do you think we ought to simply get out altogether, quit and leave?
I think we ought to view the problem in the larger context of this challenge that's posed by radical jihadism. I don't think that there's a military solution to that problem. And in that sense, I think that the military efforts in Afghanistan are one example of a wrong-headed approach to the larger problem. Ultimately, I do think we need to get out. That doesn't mean we get out next Tuesday, but there is something slightly patronizing in arguing that absent presence of the United States, assistance of the United States, that somehow the people of Afghanistan simply can't solve their own problems. And that does seem to be an assumption.
Okay, we're out of time, and I'm sorry for that. Andrew Bacevich, retired colonel, now at professor emeritus at Boston University, author of America's War for the Greater Middle East, a military history, his latest book. Cale Weston, author of The Mirror Test, America at War in Iraq and Afghanistan, formerly with the State Department. Kate Clark, with the Afghan Analysts Network, a former BBC Kabul correspondent. Eric Schmidt with the New York Times. Thank you all very much. Oh, I should say, Eric Schmidt's book, Trump administration is split on adding troops in Afghanistan. Excuse me, that's an article that appeared in the New York Times. Good to have you all. Thank you very much for joining us. Three Mile Island may not have a future. Back in a moment with that on To the Point from Public Radio International. Warren Alney here with today's Talking Point. 38 years ago, one of two nuclear reactors at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania suffered a partial meltdown and had to shut down. It was the worst accident of its kind in American history, with significant releases of radiation but no extensive health effects, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Now the second reactor may have to close, 15 years before it's due for a license renewal. Christina Simeone is Director of Policy and External Affairs at the Kleinman Energy Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
What is it that's causing the potential shutdown of this second reactor?
Well, there's a couple of phenomena that are coming together to create this situation for Three Mile Island. One, competitive electricity markets, where instead of regulators making decisions about what energy generation is dispatched and built, you have generators competing against each other to provide power and to be built. Two, very cheap natural gas coming from shale-based resources in the Marcellus Shale region of Pennsylvania. Three, hyper-competitive gas investments, a lot of interest by investors in building new and high-efficiency gas plants, which are extremely economic. And then the fourth issue is there's no price on carbon. So as a result, the resources in the market that are less competitive are finding it harder to justify their existence economically. For Three Mile Island, there's only one reactor that's operating. So the plant has less revenues to spread around its fixed costs. For example, two reactor nuclear plants generally are doing better than the single reactor plants.
So it's mainly an economic issue?
Yes, absolutely.
When the accident occurred in 1959, or since then, I should say, there has certainly been a chilling effect on nuclear power in the United States, and reactors are closing down in many places, including California. And part of the reason is that people are concerned about the waste that has built up and the nuclear materials that will be left when the reactors themselves do finally go out of business and are decommissioned. Does that have any role in what's happening now?
So, again, primarily with TMI and Three Mile Island and most reactors that we've seen, the reactors are either closing because of safety reasons or economic reasons. TMI has had safety issues in the past, but from a contemporary basis, the issue is economics. But as you go beyond the issues of power market economics, you also have to understand the local economics and local politics involved, where nuclear waste is being stored on site at these plants, and that is because of the federal government has not been able to build a permanent repository and take custody of the waste, which they were supposed to do as per the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. So as a result, the waste is being stored on site. And when these plants close, it will be fairly straightforward to decommission the plant itself and the soil and bring back a large percentage of the footprint to a decontaminated state. But the waste will remain there for an indefinite amount of time, and that has a chilling effect in bringing new investment into the community kind of the ability to attract more jobs contribute to the tax base and the emergency response services, school, property values, et cetera, that are impacted when these plants decommission.
You said there's no price on carbon. What difference would it make to a nuclear power if there were?
Well, it would. If there was a price on carbon, it would increase the revenues earned by the plants. Basically, it would make fossil fuel resources slightly less competitive based on their emissions. So, coal would be considerably less competitive. Natural gas would be incrementally less competitive, and nuclear generation would receive a new value stream because nuclear plants do, in spite of other issues which are legitimate with these plants, they do have a very real benefit of producing a significant amount of power at zero carbon.
You say, of course, that the waste is still there on site because the federal government hasn't come up with a repository, and no doubt that's true. If it did, there would be an issue of transportation, taking stuff that's going to be dangerous for hundreds of thousands of years and hauling it across the United States and putting it in the repository. Is that really practical?
Well, I would say whether it's practical or not, that was always something that was envisioned, and that's something that whether the waste was going to be reprocessed, which was kind of the assumption prior to the Nuclear Waste Policy Act that was passed in the 80s, or whether the assumption was the federal government was going to take custody of the waste, which was the plan after the Nuclear Waste Policy Act was passed, there was always going to be some element of transportation involved.
Do you think that other smaller plants might be developed in the future that don't pose the problems of volume that these big plants do?
Well, that's definitely, if you talk about the future of nuclear power, there are a lot of people who believe that the technology will be smaller, modular reactors that are cheaper and easier to build. They may have some safety benefits. They may even be able to beneficially use the spent fuel waste that is piling up around these plants. But, you know, some of these technologies are kind of relatively new, and there isn't the same kind of regulatory structure developed to that would lead to the ability to commercialize these plants. So there is definitely a regulatory framework that is missing.
Back to the issue of carbon emissions, do you think that the global warming situation will lead to more pressure for more nuclear plants?
Well, I think there is a question about, you know, do we keep the plants that we have? And there is certainly going to be a lot of pressure for that. Economically struggling nuclear plants in New York and Illinois have been able to successfully appeal to their policymakers to get some kind of carbon price or zero emission credit implemented through state-based policy. Ohio, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, or other states that are looking at those state-based policies. In addition, electricity market operators are exploring carbon pricing in the early stages. And it's unclear what the new administration at the federal level is looking at, although early indications suggest they're less interested in carbon, in pricing carbon, and maybe more interested in creating value for certain operational profiles for nuclear, something called baseload power.
Okay.
Creating subsidies to benefit baseload power.
Okay. I'm sorry, that's all the time we have. Christina Simeone, you've been very helpful, Director of Policy and External Affairs at the Kleinman Energy Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.